From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 536, SQL Question and Answer Panel at SQL Intersection Spring 2017, with guests Kimberly Tripp, Paul Randall, and Bob Ward. Recorded Wednesday, May 24th, 2017. Run As Radio is produced each week by PWOP Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. It's one of those special shows live in person. We're in Orlando at the Swan Hotel at SQL Intersection in the springtime, and we have a remarkable array of miscreants before us today. Who's been given microphones, and who's just going to pass around?
I'll be passing around.
Brent, you're doing the running for our panel of bright ones.
I do.
And, of course, the Three Stooges are in the back there, Paul and Kim and Bob Ward.
How did I get to be a Stooge? How did I get included in the Stooges? I don't know how I got lumped in there.
Not so Stoogey anymore.
Yeah.
We'll call you Harpo.
Okay, all right.
And so it's a Q&A session. Paul, take it away. Let's see what happens.
All right, so we've got, 20-odd topics on the board. Basically, anything you want to ask about SQL Server, we have someone in the room that can answer it. And if we don't have someone in the room, we'll make something up.
Yeah.
We'll make something up.
Who has a question?
That's good.
Oh, right up front here. I didn't have to walk.
So one of the biggest issues that I've had in my career with SQL and with other customers as a consultant is these companies that don't qualify their software for the next version of SQL Server. You know, 2014 comes out, 2016 comes out. Oh, wow, that has all these great features. And, you know, hey, can I upgrade? No, we haven't qualified our software for this yet. So now, with 2017 coming out, it seems that cadence is even getting faster, so this problem might even get worse. So I just like some people to speak to that and see what thoughts are.
I've actually there had one go. Of this feedback. And
it's like Talladega Nights, where the hands keep coming up.
It'd be painfully close to this. All right, so long story short, yeah, with the increased cadence, there's a lot of different aspects that we have to be cognizant of. Certification is one of them, and that's still something that we're working on. But it's definitely a pain point that we're well aware of. I don't have a tidy solution for you, because this cadence, as you notice, is getting more and more rapid. I did say in a session today after Graph, wrapping things up, that we're not going to return to the 3 to 5 year cycle. There's no guarantee about whether it's going to be 1 year, 2 year, or so on. But we know that this is a pain point. It's the reason why developers all smile at me when I say we have it happening faster, and then DBAs scowl at me because they think, oh my God, it was just a year ago. So feedback heard. So,
are you going to switch over to the model? I mean, the Windows folks are doing this. Many of the dev folks are doing this, where you have a long-term version that's going to be supported for several years, and then you're doing regular cadence updates in between.
A couple of different techniques have been discussed around that. Jury's out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Still in discussion. You care to jump in on that, Bob?
I'll go ahead and jump in. I work with our partner team quite often.
This is Buck Woody speaking.
I'm sorry. Buck Woody from the machine learning and data science team, and we face this as well. And so a product will come out and they won't certify because, well, it's moving so fast, we don't know when to put our foot down. So what we tell the partners are, when there is a compelling feature within it that will help you write less software, we're doing part of your work for you and extending the features that you have. The other side of that is, so we train them all the time and try to get them to upgrade constantly. We're constantly putting that pressure on. But the other thing we could use is your help by saying it. What they'll tell us is no one's asked for it. And we know that's not true because here you are. So we'd like you to be as vocal as you can to your vendors and say, we'd like to do this because it will help us in other areas. And that would be really useful.
So last thought there. Those are great comments, Joe and Buck. We're actually toying internally with talking to some of these vendors and asking them whether they would be certifying on a database compatibility level instead of a version.
Well, that's interesting.
And then what we might do is make a public statement, and we're talking about this, a public statement about that we would consider any functional problems at that level to be a bug if it changed. So imagine, you know, you telling your vendor that, yeah, go to move to 16, but keep your compatibility level at what you certify, make that change, that way you can still take advantage of some of the great features that come with the version. So that is something we're toying with. So.
Great question. Got another one right over here.
So adaptive query plans seem to be putting Brent's folks, you know, keeping them really busy with blog articles. Do you think they're going to put the SQL skill guys out of a job for a lot of the little things they're doing?
Yes.
And you gave it to Joe. Yeah.
3 or 4 months, I think. 3 or 4 months.
Hold on, Joe. I've been told for like 20 years, aren't you nervous about the DTA and the index tuning wizard and all of these features? And 7.0 when it shipped was zero administration? What?
Yeah, I remember that.
I'm not worried, no. But, I mean, the more loaded guns we're given with new features and 30,000 columns per table, woo-hoo. I mean, I'm not that worried. But yes, adaptive query processing is awesome. So now,
I think it's also interesting that the scope of the engine has gotten so big with every single version that there's no shop that can cover all of it. A great example of that is column store indexes, where there's this one blogger, Nico Neugebauer out of Portugal, that's his one thing, and he's written a 100-part series on that. It's just so tricky to master everything in the engine.
Yeah, and honestly, there's so much more to do. There's a lot of work for people to do deep analysis. I mentioned in an earlier session, we're helping with mitigation, so how can we resolve things right away? But we still need a human being for root cause analysis. And to me, that was always the fun part. So for years to come, you're going to have work to do in this space.
Did Woody just say make a better query processor, they'll make a worse query? Is that what you said? We're going to go there, huh?
I'm just going to say there's no such thing as a
bold person. There you go.
So given all the attention around DevOps and cloud-native patterns for computing, what do you see as the developing SQL Server story there? It's really expensive to try to shard out a SQL Server Enterprise deployment, and that makes it very difficult when you consider moving to the cloud or trying to make applications that will run on-prem and in the cloud.
I'm trying to think about what your question is exactly. Is it really more around, like, I've got these large enterprise systems and I am struggling to move to a cloud service?
Well, given the historical pattern of SQL Server licensing, I've been encouraged to have kind of the fastest processors with the fewest number of cores, with the fastest disk and the most memory on a machine, and the fewest number of SQL servers that can support my workload.
Right.
And cloud patterns are lots of small commodity machines that we can, you know, distribute a workload across. And so we've got these competing tensions of, I've got these existing patterns of how we've been writing code, and in order to make things more manageable, increase flow, that kind of thing, we're supposed to take different patterns. How is SQL Server evolving to kind of fit into that ecosystem?
Well, SQL Server is going to continue to evolve exactly what you're used to today. At least on premise, right? The promise of the cloud, though, is both for, you know, PaaS type workloads that can use our commodity at scale for a large number of users in a shared environment. But you're going to see us continue to iterate to support more enterprise type workloads and push the gamut of what customers need there as far as, will you have, for example, possible more control over a SQL Server in Azure? We just announced a private preview. You may have seen it at Build for the managed SQL Azure instance concept. And the idea there is that, can we give you the advantages of a PaaS environment, yet open up, though, the surface area of SQL Server a little bit more for things like SQL Agent, larger databases, more compute resources to run your workloads? You're going to see us try to meet the needs of both somebody running at a more smaller, medium-sized PaaS-type workload, but even push it further for even like an enterprise-type need. There's always going to be, in my opinion, for a long period of time, there's always going to be the NASCAR of SQL Server still needed for those really tight, big workloads, which is why you see us iterating on SQL 17 and continue to do that for years to come.
I'm going to ask a follow-up to that because I think I know where you're going from. I know who you are. But the thing that I always wanted to see was when Azure SQL DB first started the automatic federation stuff a while back, like you were just going to be able to query one thing and Azure SQL DB would figure out where your data lived, and that died off. I would love to see something like that because I think that that's what a lot of the NoSQL type stuff does, as Cosmos DB does. but it just doesn't seem to be there in SQL Server. And I'm only saying that as an outsider. I don't know if anybody from Microsoft wants to break NDA about things that might be coming in the future, but
I would not break NDA.
Dang. I tried.
Yeah, I was actually really interested in that feature because that would be something that would help take and be able to move an existing enterprise application, move it towards the cloud, move it towards adopting that PaaS service. Because you have to be able to shard it out when you have those smaller instances. But the managed stuff sounds pretty cool too.
But we realize that you want to do that, right? And so we realize customers want to do that. So there's no question we're not going to not continue to iterate on this. And we're going to find a way, I promise you, we're going to find a way to get large enterprise scale out workloads into our cloud service. You're not going to see that yet today necessarily. This managed instance is a step towards that.
And I guess the argument there, Stephen, you troublemaker, is if the only way for me to be able to shard out a database economically is to move off of SQL Server, that's what I'm going to end up doing. Right? Yep. I think one of these Q&As we did, I think it was the last one actually, I ended up being cornered on a conversation about why are dev folks moving to NoSQL and experimenting with those things. And one of them is the licensing model is pretty awesome when it's an open source project like MongoDB. Mm-hmm. The security model might have a few issues, but you know, at least it's easy from a perspective of, okay, yeah, we want to do this big distributed thing and I don't want to buy a lot of licenses to do it.
Just remember also, Buck just made a comment to me, which is true. You know, if you had a warehouse workload, I mean, that's exactly what Azure Data Warehouse is designed to do, is to provide all of what you need. So if it's just a warehousing workload and you're separating that out in your enterprise environment, we've already got a service that we're starting to iterate and it gives you that capability.
Yeah, I do think we are all contending with folks that are looking at their SQL servers and with the new requirements they've got and saying, which way do I go from here to scale it out and to support the workloads that are being asked of it? Mm-hmm.
So how many of you here have actually looked at the SQL Data Warehouse? Raise your hand if you've done that. Okay.
About 10 people in the room put their hand up. About 150.
Yeah, not very many people. So I highly recommend you take a look. What you described as the scale out is exactly that. We have data warehouse units, DWUs, and it's a slider or code, T-SQL or PowerShell or whatever, that can on demand scale up the processing and the databases underneath are actually on storage and they actually are SQL DB. It is automatic sharding and it's T-SQL. So select star into blah, blah, blah. It's for that. So it is what you're describing. And as far as licensing, it's a cloud model. There is no licensing. It's gone. The licensing model disappears. And I love the open source stuff. We have it all over the place and we're all friends with that now. But I will tell you, make sure you think about the supportability of this. But I've gone into a lot of shops that have not looked at data warehouse and they'll describe, this is what we want. And I'm like, well, we have this exact thing. And I show it to them like, oh, well, why didn't you say so?
So I almost wonder if it's misnamed. I mean, in theory, it's a data warehouse, but people have baggage of dealing with data warehouses going back, 20 years.
Take 5 minutes and do the tutorial that's on the web. Take 5 minutes, even with a free Azure subscription, you could get through one of those. And I teach a day-long class on this. And when I do, everybody's like, well, we should just be using this.
Thanks.
That question kind of led me into my question. This is probably going to be elementary for a lot of folks in the room, but it's a new thing for me. My current production environment is 10 physical servers, ranging either 20 or 40 core machines. I've just been told our fiscal policies have changed, and next year will be when it's time to replace that hardware. Now, I'm no longer going to be able to purchase physical machines. So for the first time next year, I'm going to have to either virtualize or do some kind of cloud solution. Now, the cloud solution is scary to my organization. So I guess this is a very general question, but I was curious if anybody had any advice. Is could I just go one for one to virtualize those 10 servers into blades, or should I really push hard for some kind of cloud solution?
Well, you got them, didn't you?
That's Brent.
I want to hear Brent.
Either Brent or me.
Yeah. Brent, have a go.
He'll take one side, I'll take the other. How's that?
Oh.
So you're lucky in that virtualization is so mature now, it's just not a big deal. It's so much easier. The first guidance I give people is go try to do a restore and time how long the restore takes. That's your first big barrier. If you get a crappy cloud solution or virtualization or a physical box, if the restore takes longer than the business is comfortable with, that's your first sign of a problem. But I would totally try to default to somebody's cloud, at least infrastructure as a service, VMs up in the cloud. Because it's cheap, it's by the hour, it's so scalable, you can make so many changes so fast. What was your opposing view?
Well, darn. that was kind of unexpected. Okay, Hillary, I think that this is the worst deal in... So it's exactly right, and I know where you're at. I deal with the U.S. government a lot, and they're very afraid of a cloud as well. So I understand the concern. But I will say exactly what Brent said. Start out with just infrastructure as a service to start. You'll have to break out your workload that way. That's lift and shift. It's fairly familiar and common, and they'll be okay with that. Once you've done a couple of wins, start looking at cloud-based services. We have analysis services in the cloud. We have data warehousing in the cloud. We have databases in the cloud. It doesn't really take a whole lot of re-architecting to make the thing work better, especially if it's green. I always tell people this, try to get a tactical win to get a strategic seat at the table. So do something that works, that solves a problem, but is, if it fails, it's not the end of the world. And then they've got some trust built up, and then move forward from there.
I would add something to Buck real quick. One easy thing you might do if you've got a development environment is consider doing that. So spin up some Azure VMs with SQL, whatever, maybe using Developer Edition, which is free. Do that in Azure VMs for a couple of your developers. And then what's really nice is we have other parts of Azure that allow you to monitor those VMs and then automatically shut them down if they're not being used. Because actually the way Azure VM works is you pay for what you consume from a compute perspective, right? So there's actually some pretty cool things from a devs type perspective that might get your foot in the door first with your company. And then they kind of show that, hey, this just is VMs. They just work. So that's sort of a thought for you to kind of get things
going.
Maybe
we should ask the question, what do you see your organization is afraid of when it comes to cloud?
Well, I don't really want to say exactly where I work, but it's the U.S. government. Ah. So,
you have a lot to be afraid of. I get that. Okay.
So the decision makers are.
Did they know about Azure Government or Azure Government
yes.
service?
Okay. Microsoft came on site a couple months ago and talked about it with us. And I'm hopeful because we've gone from 2 years ago, the word cloud was an evil thing to be avoided. Whereas now, at the level of the people I speak with anyway, there's a question of, let's talk about it. We're going to get there. Let's figure out how we're going to get there. Mm-hmm. But we're not going to get there soon enough for me to make a change in the near future. So I just have to – baby steps is a good recommendation.
Yeah.
So if you are going to stick with VMs, then the general guidance you asked about oversubscribing or like a one-to-one, I would just do a one-to-one, but pile them in like a clown car into fewer bare metal physical boxes. Just oversubscribe those boxes because most people aren't doing 100% CPU use anyway. So immediately you save money and look like a superhero. So the same troubleshooting skills that you used on physical boxes are still relevant in virtualization. It's kind of an easy road to take these days.
Well, and quick to recover from, too. You can make an experiment, see you're in trouble, and then undo the experiment.
Yeah.
And that makes a big difference in my mind. We're taking a lot less risks these days, it seems. Like, I remember buying the wrong set of hardware for a server.
Sure.
Taking 6 weeks for it to arrive and then finding 2 weeks later. Okay, that was the wrong set of hardware. Let's go again.
But you also see, though, all developers going, we're going to throw everything in this new database. And then 6 months later, you know what? We're going to try this other one over here instead.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the risk is just different.
Yeah, it's just shifted around.
This is going to be a left field question, not related to the cloud or security or anything like that. But I have to ask with some of the Microsoft guys in here, is there any kind of realistic traction on fixing the number one Connect bug in terms of votes, the string or binary data would be truncated without telling us what column it is.
Oh,
okay.
Mr. Bob Ward. Oh. I have heard of that one.
Weasel out of that one, buddy.
Oh. Yeah, no, actually, it's funny. I didn't really know much about that one, and that was at an event not long ago when somebody brought that up. I'm like, tell me more about it. And the whole audience looked like they were going to charge me in the stage, right? So I don't have an answer for you on that one. I've heard about it. I haven't dug into the details of why we're not fixing that. Somebody else might know, but I am aware of that one.
There's high visibility to it.
Yeah.
So, and the reason why I threw it over to poor Bob is because the sustained engineering aspect of it, but it affects everything. So, yes.
And I think what you're saying politely is they have seen that we're upset.
Yes.
They talk about it inside the organization.
I've seen several emails on this topic, actually.
come up
on my team, actually. So, yeah.
Know this, along with all Connect bugs, because I used to be on the product team for SQL 2008, and I came in, and my backlog was 1,300 bucks the day I started. And I also had work to do. So every morning I would churn through these. Some I couldn't reproduce. They take an enormous amount of time to do that. This one's obviously reproducible. It's a real bug. There are certain things I talked this morning about, sort of an impact map, and certain things that when you pull on that thread, it ends up undoing the whole garment. And so some bugs are that way, and they will be done, and sometimes even fixed orthogonally. I'm going to fix this over here, and that will relieve that bug, and we can't talk about it. So I'm not saying that's the case here. I'm just saying that know that none of this is trivialized, and we're not the big evil corporation that's not listening. Also, you should check out SQL on Linux. It's awesome.
there's an equivalent to that in the Windows space. When the Windows team actually fixing the length limit for your file paths involved basically restructuring all the Windows. And there's no way to actually get that bug fixed that way, but it sat there at the top of the stack as a very silly problem that they couldn't seem to overcome until that opportunity to restructure Windows came in Windows 10. And when that happened, it's like, oh, while we're here, let's do that. And they fixed it. I have a show on it, oddly enough. I think that's exactly what you're saying. Sometimes one of these things shows up in a way it's like, wow, this is pretty fundamental to the system. It's not a small thing to fix. And when an opportunity to make that major change comes, maybe we'll get it then. But we can't do the bugs in the order that they show up because they're not all the same.
One thing about Connect, I might have pushed a lot of bugs through Connect.
Maybe.
So one of the things you have to keep in mind, when you go to Connect, don't show up with a pitchfork and a torch and like be angry about something and just say, I don't like this. The biggest value you get out of there is not having a bunch of votes. Put a comment. Add a comment and explain why this fixing this issue is important for your business. It takes a lot, you know, it adds development time. Quantify it if you can, right? That stuff, it weighs a lot more heavily than just a bunch of
I can't upgrade because of this. I can't certify my product because of this.
I can't give you more money because.
Right.
Seriously, yeah. Right. Yeah. I would add right now that if you make a statement about what you just said, I can't migrate to a new version of SQL because of this, that will get a lot of attention in our team.
Yeah,
so I'm just adding that little nugget.
When I was on the SQL customer advisory team, we would frequently get bugs fixed in next version with as few as 4 comments from 4 customers, because it was that impactful to, you know, we just had to build a case. So that stuff does come in. So I don't think it's necessarily 1,000 votes. It can be 4 votes that are huge, you know, and lots of people in lots of different areas.
Yep, right.
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, lots of different people in lots of different areas are always fighting for these. You know, we always have our favorite bugs inside the company when I was there, and I know people still have this way now.
Wait, there's bugs?
No.
That we kind of have we have bugs we champion that we want fixed version after version after version, you know, to eventually get them out of bug jail. So,
out of bug jail. All right, another question.
Yeah, there's this wonderful little feature in SQL Server not a lot of people are using. It's called data collectors. And I find that it's immensely wonderful to see what's going on historically, to troubleshoot some things, see locking, to see some issues. And I talk to a lot of people in the industry, talk to a lot of people here on stage, and it doesn't seem people are very familiar with it. They haven't used it very often. They kind of refer you to, just use Idera, use SQL Sentry, this and that, and that's great. But in the end, it always seems that SQL Server has this wonderful feature, and it was just fixed in the latest cumulative update for 2016, so it was very difficult as you hobble along using it. But is that something that we're not paying attention to, we're ignoring, we're not promoting? I think it's something that would be really helpful to a lot of DBAs.
Yeah, so the data collector was part of the whole centralized management push that was in 2008 R2. And so it languished as we moved into the cloud. But no, it's not a deprecated feature or anything like that. And I feel you. I really do. I'm still mad about English Query. I think I was the one company on the planet that used it, and they ditched that. And I'm still kind of bitter.
I was incredibly excited about performance data collection when it came out in 2008 and was improved with some of the features that they did in 2008 R2. The problem that I have with it is that there was so much emphasis on the cloud that there weren't any enhancements to it. And unfortunately, if you end up doing a lot of data collection for a real business cycle, not the default, which is 2 weeks, and you do more than 1 or 2 servers, the problem is that the management data warehouse where that data is collected grows very large very quickly and becomes very unmanageable. And not to push other products like SentryOne, but they have thought about this problem And unfortunately, because Microsoft's focused a lot on the cloud and managing the cloud, they haven't, in my opinion, sorry, put as much into management on-prem, and that has allowed third-party products to really go much further ahead than PDC, performance data collection. And so my problem with it is anytime I talk to a customer, anytime I work with a customer that's used it, they end up telling me that it grew to 3 terabytes very quickly. They couldn't manage it. The reports were incredibly slow. It's not well indexed. And yes, could we make those enhancements? Yes. Could we make it better? Yes. But it just hasn't been done.
Because if you
well said,
the way that I used it that I think was right was that each database gets its own data warehouse database. Then you throw page compression. Then you throw page compression on there, and you save 80%. So it's a lot of times it's just like people aren't being instructed on how best to use it. I mean, you have to tweak it. You have to work with it. So.
I mean, I'm with you. Yeah. Page compression solves some problems. Throwing it on solid state drives solves some problems. Throwing more memory at it. But now I've got another server that I'm paying another license for that I'm throwing a whole bunch of resources at, specifically because it's not as optimal internally as it could be, and I would much rather throw some resources at internally optimizing it and dealing with things like cleaning up that data and aggregating that data down so that we're not storing raw fact data, which is unfortunately what it does. So I'd really like to see some emphasis from Microsoft, but I would also argue they're trying to optimize their management of Azure-based environments, not necessarily on-prem. And I could also argue that third-party products do such a good job that there's not a lot of motivation for Microsoft to do it when they're putting so much emphasis in Azure. So, I mean, just playing both sides there. But I agree. I mean, there's some custom data collections, very cool, but you do have to kind of micromanage it. And then if you do want to do reports across databases, there's no good way to do that. So I have this love-hate relationship with it. You know, I would love for it to be improved, but I don't see a lot of reasoning for them to improve it, especially because there's good third-party products that are out there. And the price of the third-party products in a lot of cases isn't terrible. And in fact, it's actually really reasonable. So it's something I would look at. It's a tough one, Bob.
Yeah, I mean, Kim, those are all great answers. We should hire you to. So hey, it's not deprecated, it works. You see we've done some fixes to it, but if it helps you any, I don't see any major enhancements in the near future coming to that. You saw what we did with Query Store. That's a particular feature that we built in the engine versus using the data collection approach. Yeah. I think you see us invest more, like Kim talked about, is to put more diagnostics into the engine that others can leverage. That's really the way I see it. I think it's pretty true to say that's kind of our strategy right now.
Well, I'd also say, too, it's a tool, and the problem is it's like a really heavy screwdriver, and if you're in the club, you can use it as a hammer, but you have to know that, and then you have to want to go build things with it, and most people in here don't want a hammer. They want a dollhouse. Just give me the dollhouse, and to me, that's what Query Store is.
How do you screw in something with a dollhouse?
And then...
So, Brett, I never really thought of Query Store as a dollhouse, but that's interesting.
Yes.
Barbie
comes in. And I'm madly in love with Query Store. It's amazing, and it's just built in, and you can do all kinds of stuff with it. It's so much better than trying to build your own dollhouse with a heavy screwdriver, right? That's what I always say.
Okay, I get it now. Great analogy.
Oh, yeah, Buck Woody. Buck Woody points out you could use to move to MySQL, I believe is what he just said.
Yeah. All right, I got another question back here.
I got two things I got issues with. One is partitioning. The fact that you got a single partition key.
I was in Vegas in the fall, and Kim got a lot of the questions, right? And I've been getting a lot of them, so yes, please, thank you.
Okay. One is a single partition key and lack of sub-partitioning. Yeah, I mean, Oracle is far superior in partitioning. And
Whoa!
Okay, Brent, start the timer. Let's see how long we can go. Okay.
Are we doing timing now?
Not even in comparison.
That's what I meant.
Materialized views is the second part.
Vegas set the record. She set the record.
No, I understand. There's two things I'm saying that I have.
But I will give materialized views at Oracle a ding on the VS and index views, for sure.
Yeah, there's no comparison there.
But that's not partitioning.
No, partitioning I have problems with, because single partitions, all you can have is one key for your partition. Oracle, you can have multiple keys.
One key that is a persistent computed column, and you can partition over that.
I realize, but it's still, you've got to write your queries obviously to take advantage of partition, you know, elimination. And if you don't do them right, you know,
you don't write good queries to leverage your partitioning structure, you're not going to get partition elimination. I mean, you can't assume that they only want 2017 without them saying, I only want 2017. So you still have to have well-formed queries and well-formed structures.
Understood, but, you know, like with Oracle, I can have multi-part partition keys without trying to put them together, without having them to rewrite their whole queries. I mean, they already have the queries there to take advantage of it because, for example, on a financial, you're looking at like an accounting period and a fiscal year. I mean, those are natural type things you're going to put in. But to put them in together and have to put them as the in your query together rather than as a separate piece means a tremendous amount of rewrite. And I just think it's poorly put together. It's easy to put partitioning together with Oracle. I'm not an Oracle bigot. I use both just as much. But I'm saying is I feel like it's a far superior product when it comes to those things.
That's why it costs $47,000 a core.
Well, that could be true.
Right? SQL Server's a little cheaper.
But Microsoft's not a hell of a lot more cheaper anymore.
It's $40,000 a core cheaper. $40,000 a core. If that's not expensive to you, give me a loan. Your money. Yeah.
Okay, so let me take just one step back. The way that partitioning is handled in Oracle is very different than SQL Server. There are more features that are more easily accessible in Oracle, but are still available in SQL with the right design. So I would say that there are some cases where working a little bit harder within the infrastructure of SQL would get you the same gains and benefits. Like people argue with me all the time, you don't have list-based partitioning. Well, we do if you end up doing range-based partitioning with no values between the values that you're partitioning over, and then bam, you have list-based partitioning. We don't have hash-based partitioning. Well, if you do a computed column that is a hash, then you can partition with hash-based. But we don't have a feature. We did.
We used to have one before we pulled it out of 2005.
Right? I mean, the first white paper that I did partitioning, I actually had like 20 pages on hash partitioning, and it got pulled because you can do everything with hash with a range if it's designed right. So to a certain extent, I believe in the simpler partitioning model. And in more complicated scenarios where you want to have secondary levels of partitioning, it is more challenging. However, I have a trick for you. With partition views, people don't usually realize this. If you actually have, and I usually combine partition tables and partition views in my partitioning scenarios, which is architecturally more challenging, but way, 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 way more flexible, more powerful, and a lot more performant because of things like statistics and so forth that are at the table level. But here's the beauty of separate tables. You can actually have multiple constraints and therefore multiple partitioning keys, basically. So I might have date as my primary way of partitioning, and I might have separate table by year. Theoretically, I have my row IDs that are also somewhat partitioned, right? Because they're sequential as well. They're somewhat correlated to date. And the point is, if you constrain those tables that are also constrained by year, by the ID range, then you can actually do partition elimination over either key as you go through the views that sit on top of that. Now, if you're doing date subsets, and you partition by date, even though it's a single column, there are a lot of functions on date that work within partitioning. So that would still work. And so I would argue that it might be easier to do exactly what you're doing in Oracle because there are more flexible ways of partitioning in Oracle. But I could also argue that we create a separate function and a separate scheme, and then you can use those across multiple tables. So you can actually align multiple tables on that same partitioning strategy with less work because you're not having to put that partitioning information in each table's design. So my point is, I can argue on both sides. I'm not an Oracle expert, I don't claim to be one, and I know there are some things that they are superior. But I have not met a partitioning scenario that I could not resolve with a little bit of architectural work and make it work incredibly well. And that is one of the key things I do as a consultant is partitioning. And that is one of my favorite areas of like dealing with DLPs.
No.
It's one of my favorite topics. I'm happy to chat a little bit more. I do agree to a point. Okay, I am agreeing to a point, and like index views are another great discussion. I'm not sure of that, but materialized views can be disconnected from the basics.
Almost six.
Oracle definitely hits us on index views, or materialized views versus our index views.
Is there anything out of that that you'd go, I really wish we had this one thing in partitioning? Like, is there anything you're desperate that you think maybe Oracle has? No?
Well, okay, with partitioning, there's probably about 15 things that I wish we
stats.
Did a little bit better, one of which is stats, mm-hmm. Okay? I can help VLTs, very large tables, by using filtered stats, but I can also architecturally split a VLT and then get real partition-level stats because they're not partitions anymore, they're tables. And then I have no limitations with like interval subsumption, things like that. So there are huge benefits by architecturally breaking down some of these large tables into separate chunks, but what do I really wish? I mean, I guess I have the pieces there if I choose to do
to build them. It.
But the problem is it is more challenging architecturally. So partition level stats would be huge. I'd love that. But yeah, there's a bunch of, like even read-only partitions.
Regarding
file, I know, file groups.
I mean, I just learned a class on partitioning. I don't know about you guys, but I mean, I just had a session. What was the session on partitioning? I was
Ladies and gentlemen, the 7-minute answer.
We have broken the record. Yay! Oh, man.
Well done, Brett.
Well done, Brett. Good job.
6-minute mark.
With a little goading.
Kimberly, I wanted to talk just real quick about partition level stats. So, the key thing is they're there. We just don't use them at the level
no,
of.
Wait a minute.
No, no, no.
Come on. They're there.
No.
We just don't use them.
No, I know.
Come on, Joe.
But there's hope. Not a new hope.
There's hope.
But there's hope. There's hope. And the thing is because we munge it up to the level where you end up with 200 histogram steps no matter what. And it's totally understood why at the per partition level stats would be useful. And we're looking at different things. But there's no timeline. There's no guarantee. But it's.
It's a great point. I mean, there is a reason it's not there already, and that's shut up, Frank. Okay. In that, if you think about it for a second, when a query gets optimized, right, the idea is not to get the best plan, it's to get a good plan fast. Well, if statistics are ginormous, I mean, if you have 1,000 or 15,000 partitions, right, having 15,000 statistics to have to, you know, collate, to look at, to analyze your data would be. It'd be prohibitive in and of itself. We wouldn't be able to do that and do optimization quickly. So statistics have to be small to be useful. But having said that, when queries are more isolated, if we did have statistics that were more accurate over certain levels of data, that would give us better estimates, better plans, which is where filtered stats come in. So I do argue that we've had pieces to simulate partition level statistics for a while, but they are limited. They're not perfect. Partition level stats would be better. So, I mean, there are arguments on both sides there. I mean,
I think you just argued both of them.
I did.
And did it well.
We'll call that the 90-second coda.
And did it well.
All right, ready for a new question?
Sure. Yes. I don't know. That was good.
I'm out.
Okay, so two of the speakers this week have spoken about data science and data scientists and have had kind of a call to action for those of us here to get more involved with that. I have two questions about that, and maybe they can be answered together. The first is, amongst the data professionals that are here in this room, whom do you see would be the best candidates to make that jump to go toward data science professionally? You know, would it be like, you know, the analyst and business intelligence experts? Would it be the DBAs? That sort of thing. And the next question that I have is specific, since we don't know a lot about the, even though our lives are very much impacted by them, we don't know a lot of what data scientists are doing day by day. What are the challenges that they have that are big hurdles for them to get over that they would be benefited from our expertise to go through?
I think that actually is cutting off.
Really? Is it turning off?
Little further off, Woody. There, yes, but thanks. Yeah, yeah. I know where you live.
So the first thing is, who can get into the data science area? It's one of those terms. It actually has a defined meaning, but it's one of those terms that's being very loosely applied at the moment. But anyone who is sort of fascinated by the big three areas, which is sort of the maths, It's just primarily statistics and linear algebra. And then the second part would be...
Yay! Statistics and linear algebra!
Not just
they're based on it.
And, well, that's true. Yeah. The second area would be sort of the big data structures around things like data warehouse and Hadoop and all these other kinds of technologies, including Polybase and SQL Server. You've been playing around with Polybase and SQL Server. You're headed there. And then the third is the sort of domain knowledge. You need to know either a lot about a particular business or a little about a lot of businesses and what patterns emerge when all businesses try to do optimization or some sort of fraud detection, whatever that happens to mean for that business. So if you're, that's kind of your bailiwick, you like those things, and those are interesting, then that would follow then who would best be suited to get into it. And I would say on two ends, and Shep, I'll get your thoughts on this too, the two ends I see go most often from the data professionals. Now, yes, business analysts are absolutely headed toward this direction because they're 90% of the way there a lot of times. But I see them headed from the people that do SSIS.
Don't say that again. The light's dimmed.
I've got a couple of sessions recorded just for that. Just be careful when you start finding it comes up with some odd.
Don't search for a day in the life of Buck Woody, though.
I was going to say.
Don't go there.
What the heck, Buck?
The session last year here on a day in the life of a data scientist, we talk about what they do every day. And one of the things is spend a lot of time on there, one of the things
I know, who knows what
that's. And that's just bread and butter, an SSIS person. When they see SSIS, they're like, what is this sorcerer? They love it. They're data scientists. They love this. And
you're always on.
Is the people on the other end, which is the visualizations. So at the end of the day, a data scientist, most of our professionals I know make graphs. That's what they do. They take a whole bunch of data and then make a graph out of it. So if somebody's good with visualizations, Power BI, or business services, those two can come back towards the middle. So I think that one answer does in fact sort of lead to the end. Remember the question?
If that's your answer, that's fine.
Okay.
So I think the answer is a little bit more complex than that, because when I left Microsoft a year and a half ago, I've kind of spent the last year and a half trying to figure out how to respond to that. And in the data science keynote yesterday, I spent a lot of time trying to, I mean, DataCamp did the most amazing visualization of what were basically the 8 or 9 jobs and what those jobs do. I think that the DBA has a role in R, because they DBAs naturally are helping people troubleshoot T-SQL, so they end up writing T-SQL relatively well. The longer they do it, the better they get. A lot of the data wrangling can be done in SQL in the engine, so you don't ever have to worry about it. And like he said, it, and I found this out when I was doing data science at Microsoft, 80% of a data science job, and not just the data science, I mean, not just the data scientist, 80% of a data science project is in the data wrangling. And we never did a project with one person. Every time we did a project, we had a minimum of 5 people on that project. And the first 80% of that was domain knowledge, learning the data, cleaning the data, and getting it ready. And most of the time, 80% of that data, ironically, same number, would go away because it was garbage. We couldn't use it for a model. And then we finally got to the last 20% of the project, which is where we needed people that had master's and PhDs in this domain to come up with something useful. Now, as far as, like, and this is kind of a many-layered answer. There have been anecdotally information in the media, especially that targets us, that want to sell you data science, say that there will be 1.5 million data science openings in the next 10 years. I believe there are going to be 1.5 million jobs that need some level of data science. But it's going to be, I mean, all the positions are going to have it. I've been asked this this week, it's like, should I do Python? Should I do R? How should I get in? Even if you're not using SQL Server, there's still a game for you in that field. And some of it may be the fact that you focus on the visualization pillar of data science, which is fantastic. I mean, that's kind of the storytelling element. And you don't need anything to do with data science to do that. That's just visualization and storytelling. But that's the end of the, that's usually the end of the data science project. It could be, you know, the business analyst aspect. There's much activity here. What's going on?
No, I want to kind of ask you guys a question about this. From my limited knowledge of data science, one of the things that I've seen is that you can leverage a lot of these data science algorithms from the cloud, where you don't necessarily need to have that deep knowledge, but you could then apply some of those algorithms to your own data as long as that data is designed for that model. So
here's the
problem. I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
I just think it's, I don't know enough to speak intelligently about it.
Yeah, no, and I'm not going to lie. I thought that while I was at Microsoft, and my opinion changed when I left and actually learned how to do this. And the reason I say that, and I showed this yesterday when I was doing Azure Machine Learning, is the fact that you can create a regression model in AML, Azure Machine Learning, yet you don't know if you've actually created a good model. The 25-year-old rule is, if your R-square is good, you're fine. That's actually not true. I can have a model where all of the variables will show up as completely irrelevant, which means they have a high p-value, which is yet another problem in data science. P-values are falling out of favor because I can hack them. So I can have a model that has high p-values, which anecdotally means that all my variables are garbage, but have an R-square of 95% or 85%. Which means the model can actually predict something.
And it looks great.
And ironically, I can predict something using that model. It actually will come up relatively within a, you know, let's say a 10 or 15% margin of error, which isn't too bad. So the problem with the cloud is the fact, and especially in AML, and I asked our data scientists 3 weeks ago when I wrote this AML session, when I spent all this time learning this, and now I start dumping this stuff in the cloud, I'm like, all my data, all the errors that I need to figure out if this isn't a good model are gone. They're not there. So I asked the data scientist, how do you do this? They're like, we do it all in Python and AML or in R, and then we move it into the cloud as the last
step. That's right. And so what he's saying there is absolutely true, is that you will get, in business intelligence, if you don't write the query properly, it fails. But in data science, you will get an answer. If I sum up 10 numbers and I get the average, I come back with a number. Right. You have no idea what that number means. So I get very nervous about what you just said there. And by the way, we are, and it's a great question. We are often, Microsoft and Google and everybody else are often at fault for democratizing data science. You have to be extraordinarily careful. And it depends on what you're working with. Yes, if your R value is good, you can get within 10 or 15%. But if you're making a drug, I'd appreciate you not accepting a 15% rate of failure. Because right. That's 15, you know, people out of every, that every die. Yeah. Right. I'd rather not. So the point is, you will get an answer and it feels cool. There's a graph and a chart and you got 95% and you're like, oh, well, this isn't that hard. But you're not always sure what you're looking at, which is why I said the data wrangling, the visualization, those are the two ends that are really kind of safe.
So just to finish off real quickly, I was asked this question and it didn't even occur to me until somebody asked me, and it was several people that came up. If you are a database administrator where you spend more time in T-SQL, R will look more familiar to you than would Python. And if you're more in the developer space, Python would look more familiar to you. It's as if it's a different mindset that we have. I spent my life, early days in ironically COBOL, which was made fun of this morning by Buck.
Well, I'm happy to make fun of
that. I spent my
too.
Early days in software engineering, and then I moved into T-SQL, you know, quite a bit later. But so I can kind of go back and forth between something like Python. But I've also noticed that if you're kind of in a scripting mentality, you do better with certain other scripting type languages. R can do functions, but it's very much resembles a scripting type language, where Python much more resembles a development like language. And both can do the exact same. And the favored visualization plot, ironically, is ggplot, which lives in both Python and R, written by the same guy. So that's really beneficial. And the thing is, you don't have to worry about the data science. Don't get freaked out when you're like, okay, do I need to do random forest or linear regression or multiple polynomial? If you don't have a reason to do it, don't worry about it. Just get familiar with the language and start using it against things you can do with it, you know? And that's kind of the thing. Visualizations using R against a SQL Server would be really cool. And that would be R calling SQL Server to get the data out, not the other way, and dumping it on a drive somewhere.
And I would say those 1.5 million jobs or whatever, again, exactly what you said, you can rent a data scientist and they'll come in and say, we rent them out. In Microsoft Consulting, we have bona fide data scientists. One of the guys that's one of our data scientists is on the R consortium helping to develop the R language. So you can rent these people and they'll say, here's what I need. And they'll get the team from the data professionals and the visualization. They'll tell you, these are the features, these are the labels I need. Get me this. And then I'll give you the algorithm in an API and you can spit it back and forth. And then here's how you visualize that. And they walk off and you're still in place. And that works fine.
By the way, real quick. So I work with two different customers and they had a data scientist in the room and DBAs in the room. We did 1 week labs with them. And the biggest value that I would say you should look for, if you're a DBA and you know a data scientist, find out what's taking too long. So we had process that was multi-week to execute. So these data scientists generate these models. They're pulling across hundreds of millions of rows. They're bringing it over locally to our studio. They're pushing it back. They keep on iterating. Pushing that compute context to SQL Server alone reduces it significantly. So we had a two-day process go down to less than 1 hour. And the DBA in the room was able to help through column store indexes. They were able to help through taking things like there's an aggregate function in R that takes 12 seconds to run versus your select, product, key, sum, and group by using a T-SQL equivalent. It's sub-second. So from a real tangible perspective, look for their pain points. It will be duration and then also data munging, like as Buck mentioned. So quick hits.
Great question. Another one over here.
So a little bit change of topic here. Availability groups and distributed transactions. Brent actually tweeted and or blogged about this not too long ago. So I have several customers who want to implement availability groups, as many do, right? They have a lot of great benefits. However, a lot of these applications that my customers use have linked servers. And one of the design things that you use with availability groups is if you have databases that are, you know, related to the same application, you want to put those together in the same availability group. However, the article says in SQL 2016 and prior, where more than one database involved in the transaction is in the same availability group, it is not supported. So do I, you know, how hard and fast is that? Do I tell the customer, you know, this is going to work great and it's going to keep and have a lot of uptime and give you all these great benefits. But, you know, in the chance of a failover, you might lose some data. So I've had a lot of discussions in this internally. Should I be really concerned with that? Should I say, well, you've got linked servers, availability groups really aren't for you unless you want to do the one case in SQL 2016 where I have two separate availability group clusters that are never gonna cross-pollinate on the same instance, and that's okay, or really, don't worry about it, it's no big deal.
It depends on legally how little data you're allowed to lose. So, for example, I'm blogging about this faux pas project that I'm doing right now, thousands of databases and all this, and they're legally not allowed to lose data. And so we have to have every database where we're doing cross-database transactions has to live on separate SQL servers. That the Books Online page that says there's no support has a beautiful example down it. I love how good Books Online is getting and very clear and distinct. They have a beautiful example down on the bottom explaining when it won't work. The awesome news is it's coming with a fix in 2017, just not until then. So what I tell customers is if you read this Books Online example and in this weird failover situation, you're okay with that, then just roll with it. Because half the time your data is really not that important anyway. It's cat pictures. It's, you know, executive reports. Your queries use no lock. It doesn't really matter. But yeah, if it's legally required, they got to be on separate servers.
Okay, this is a question. But with a distributed transaction that's marked, why can't you... Oh, you'd still have data loss, but you could at least sync everybody to the same point in time. So I was thinking for the critical one, you could do that.
But you get data loss.
The issue is the data loss. All right.
And it was the same thing in database mirroring as well.
Right.
Same thing.
Can't you recover from that if you fell back to the original node?
Still lose data.
Jonathan!
Still lose data.
Yeah, I had a client call, sir.
Give the man a microphone if he's going to talk.
Yeah. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Well, I was asking a question from Bob.
Oh, no, I mean... used to lose data in that scenario, but 17, we did announce one of our CTPs we just released that we will support a cross-database transaction.
Is there
as
any
well.
Chance that'll be backported at all?
Don't know about that. Just got it in there in 17 now. So.
Word crappy is strong, but the part of the setup of the availability group, you have to set it up from the beginning specifically for cross-database transactions, specify how the failover will be handled.
Yeah, so it's not something you can reconfigure on the fly?
No.
Add feature in?
No. Even in 2016.
Yeah, even in 2016, you have to have DTC support enabled when you create the AVG,
right.
Or you have to take a downtime and destroy the AG, create it with DTC support enabled per database, and then join everything back to it. So,
And even that
a lesson learned from a very
ask me
recent
how
implementation,
I know.
Right? So it was something DTC support had been discussed, but when the actual implementation rollout was done, it was a hind thought, and afterwards it was oops, we have to tear this down and start over.
Everybody's got great big maintenance windows, Joe. It's no big deal.
That was Jonathan Cahias.
There you go. All right, 5 minutes left. Last questions? Well, maybe we're done. We've got a closing session coming up. Let's have a big hand for our panel group. And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.